Welcome to Fairly Critical, a podcast where we talk about movies and all sorts of film and media-related things. I'm your host, Brian, and...
I'm Jamie, and I just took a drink.
That's fantastic. And we're really happy. This is our first podcast. It's number one.
And we're uno.
Yeah, so bear with us. It's going to be interesting. We're going to grow together. Today, we are discussing Ender's Game.
Ender's Game. Fantastic book that my wife brought to my attention years ago, and I was indignant about reading for so long.
Indignant?
Well, I mean, she was pushing it so much that I didn't want to really get into it. I thought she was kind of overselling it, maybe. And I tried reading it, and, you know, moving my eyes across pages was seemed so archaic. So when I got my audiobook version of it, it was like, oh, this is much easier. I can right. handle that. So
before
I went ahead and...
Before the audiobook.
Yeah. But, I mean, hey... The story was there, it was great, and she was right, and since then they've made this great film that I enjoyed.
Yeah, funny story about that. The way that I came into Ender's Game was very similar to the way you came into Ender's Game, except for it was you
right.
who I was telling me and bit. Telling me about this book, and I'm like, I don't want to read this book. I think you might have undersold it, I don't know.
Well, I knew the danger, see, of right. overselling it, so I was trying to just lay it out there.
Yeah, so where Jenny oversold it, I think you might have undersold it, but finally, I think I broke down, and I'm like, fine, I'm going to get the audiobook, and so I ended up listening to it, and I was excited, I was thrilled, and I loved it. It was great. I loved it so much that I went and listened to most of the rest of the series.
Yes,
a lot there. We'll try not to talk about.
Since because, I haven't heard it or read it either.
Right, and it's so good. I will warn everyone, since this is a movie review cast, I don't have to say spoilers, because this is all spoilers.
Yeah, by its nature, this is one exactly. big old spoiler. So
we should just rename it Spoiler Fest.
We're like, here's that moment. Ding! For you, those of you who want to tune out now, for right. that case, do so.
Turn it off, rethink your life, why you downloaded a movie podcast.
Put us on pause, yes. and then go listen to the audiobook, and then come back and
right.
join us.
Listen to the audiobook, then go to the theater, watch the movie. When you're done watching the movie, then come back and listen, and we will love you more for it.
Now, one interesting thing about this this book, whether it be read or audio, you know, it's it was something that when I did listen to the audiobook, Orson Scott Card talks quite a bit afterwards, and in his afterword talks about the film possible being made, and how it had been on the books for so long, and he had turned down, as he put it, truckloads of money because the script was not going to be a good representation of his book.
Right, and he's trying to protect his property.
And while most people will say, "Yeah, I want to protect my original source material," this guy was definitely like, "No, this can't happen." And apparently, he turned down a lot of things, but for good reason. He had talked about how people wanted to have Ender have a love interest and make them teenagers, and there was a lot of things that kind of went against the whole point behind this story.
I was even upset that in the movie, I mean, they set him, well, he's probably about 13.
Well, and that's the thing is, Asa Butterfield playing Ender was perfect. I thought he was the way he looked in Hugo would have been awesome if he had been that small.
He did do a great job.
But unfortunately, he kind of lengthened out and got taller than, for lack of a better term.
Damn him for growing.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's all about the emotions and stuff like that there, too. So that I think he captured. So it was cast very well, and it was just unfortunate that he was just so doggone lanky.
I do agree with that. He was taller. And for a jump ahead second, let's talk about Bonzo. Because that kid was like a quarter of his height. I don't know what was going on there. Right. In the book, I don't remember him being described as being that small.
No, see,
but then Ender was supposedly, what, six
yes.
when he met Bonzo?
I think he was suggested, I probably have this wrong, for those of you fans out there who are listening to this, I apologize, but I got the impression that he was short. But shorter than the other older kids, certainly not shorter than Ender. And in the film, that is an unfortunate reality. But again, the casting of that character—I mean, the kid looked and acted exactly like my Bonzo.
That is true. That kid was angry
yes.
on a lot of levels.
Oh yeah,
I'm guessing because of his nose and possibly his parentage
and those big old ears.
Yeah, that was. He was I mean, good actor, unfortunate looking. Hopefully he grows into his face.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, maybe. Hopefully. At least he'll grow into his face and maybe not his big boy pants because he's so short. But, yeah, I mean, again, we're kind of putting the cart before the horse here. The story is king here, and I felt like the film really kind of captured that. And there's so many things we don't get, you know, when you watch a movie that's been based on a popular book anyway. And because it had been like 20 some odd years that in the making, you knew that he was going to be pretty specific about what he wanted to have in this thing. But you knew that they couldn't possibly pull off all that stuff because there's so much content.
And that's true. We talked about it earlier. I mean, you know how I feel about it, where I think everything that they did show from the book was spectacular.
Right.
And I was more disappointed with some of the big plot lines that they left out that would really lead them to a sequel, which based on this movie, I'm thinking they're not going to do.
Ooh, see, now I thought maybe they could go there if they wanted to. And it could be based on the response that this film gets or whatever, or whether Orson Scott Card has even entertained the idea. I think they left out enough that maybe that was one of their driving reasons for not showing some of that, so they could do something else with it.
I mean, I suppose they could show it as a series of flashbacks. For those of you that haven't read the other books, the second book picks up many, 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 many hundreds of years in the future. And another thing that bothered me about the movie is they barely mentioned the Ansible, which in the book is, I mean, paramount to the story. It's one of the almost a character with how much they talk about it and how much it plays in. But they learn how to travel via the Ansible, which basically lets them get someplace quickly to them that's a very long distance away, but it still takes them the same amount of time, which I mean is kind of a bogus way to space travel. I don't know. So it's like, if it would normally take you 20 years to get there, you could get there in 3 days. But literally 20 years will have passed.
Right.
So that being said, there's time there that they could show in flashbacks if they wanted to do a sequel. Right. But I think for anyone who didn't read the books, a lot of the things that transpired during this book that were left out would feel forced. Like, I didn't see that. Where did that come from?
Like, how does that factor in all of a sudden? All right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, and also we're being it's interesting because we're being pretty conservative here with the spoilers part of this, because we really haven't really talked too much about what the story is. And I think we're kind of so far talking to some people who may have already read and or heard and seen the film. But for those who have not, I think a certain amount of explanation should be in order. And that is that you have a story where in the future, young people are looked on as being the future soldiers that could then somehow save the Earth. And this is always implied that the Earth needs saving. But mainly by reflecting on the past and this one great soldier, Maser Rackham, who by control of propaganda and other information was sold to the greater public as being the hero and the reason why we now live the way we do, because he sacrificed himself or did whatever he had to make things happen. But that's what sets this whole thing up.
True.
And what we join Ender.
Ben Kingsley killed that.
Oh, absolutely. Well, he's always...
Ben Kingsley. He's knighted, right?
I believe so. Ben Kingsley? Yes. Oh, yeah. I mean, he can go in and have his face painted and do all that crazy stuff as he wants, because he's just going to own the scene.
Exactly.
You know, and there was a couple of key instances where he just really... It was like I was watching the book. You know, and so, again, going back to that, and specifically the audiobook for me, because that afterward by Orson Scott Card is very key, because what he says at the end of that, whether you've read this or seen this or not, something that he says, well, really when it comes to making a film out of this story, nothing is going to ever beat the movie that just played out in your mind reading the book, and specifically listening to the book. So his preferred way of ingesting this story was the audiobook, apparently. He said that that's the best way to experience it. It's like a radio play, because they do have different voices. It's not just one person's voice voicing everything, although one voice does voice a lot of it.
And the voice acting was really great. I know this is not an audiobook.
No, it's not an audiobook review.
But because this was such a big book, and you know, it's a big tie to the movie, I think we're justified and disgusting, at least this time.
Oh yeah, it has to be there because it is a really good way of, like he said, ingesting the story. And you know, like you, I feel like there's some things that could have been missed. There's one specific scene, like for instance, his whole Ender's character, you know, is a very reluctant hero. He while he's reluctant and does and has these morals he's struggling with along the way, the kid never loses a battle.
Right.
I mean, not only does he win battles, you know, whether it be just the fight with the neighborhood bully or defeating an entire race or whatever he doesn't lose a battle, and he does so decisively. And he's kind of like a counter bully. He like kind of comes in and just very methodically lays waste to whoever challenges him.
That's true. And let's talk about that for a minute, because you have fairly young children getting into some really aggressive fighting situations where, as an adult watching it, I had moments where I was just like, oh no, you know, like, oh, it's like you get into it so much.
Oh yeah.
And you can really feel for, I think, both sides of the situation. I mean, you know, you've known kids like that.
Right.
You've seen kids that may have been bullied, and, the thing about that I liked about Ender, and it was in the book, but they really portrayed it well in the movie, is he doesn't start fights.
No, but he ends them.
When the fight escalates, he does everything he can to stave it off by trying to back down, trying to do whatever, and then at the point that it's inevitable,
Game over.
I mean, they call him Ender for a reason.
Yes, that's right.
He's the Ender of the fight.
And I don't know if in the movie they mentioned that, like the way they did in the book, that his real name is Andrew.
Right, it's
and
Andrew.
He chose for himself the name Ender.
Well, I thought they said that it was because his sister called him Ender
by accident,
because she couldn't say Andrew when she was little. And so that's how he got the name Ender.
But he kind of adopted it freely.
Right. And in the movie, they sort of just said, you know, like, well, the one kid was like, it was Bean. He's like, your name is Ender. That's kind of a weird name. He's like, and then he's like, well, what's your name? Bean.
Yeah. Exactly. And there was, for anybody who heard, and I did listen to the first part of Ender Shadow, where Bean kind of, in the film, has a little homage to that book when he says, yeah, Bean, not worth a bean. That's directly from the text of that, and that was obviously there for the fans. Now, speaking of things that are there for the fans, there's a million things that you, as a fan of the book, whether you read it or listened to it or whatever, will obviously think, oh, well, I want to have something, you know, this shown. There is one scene that I was kind of hoping for, and it's such a throwaway scene that it could have easily done it, but I found out why they didn't do it. And what I'm referring to is that while in battle school, as he, you know, what we found out is Ender is this reluctant hero. He goes through these series of challenges where they're pushing him ridiculously, and yet he's still maintaining. And it doesn't matter how many times they make him go to battle school or actually join the a battle in the battle room and go up against it. Each time he's going up against increasingly insurmountable odds that he overcomes every time.
Right.
But the thing that we don't get to see in the film is that in the book he develops a certain confidence and or just following through. And what happens is that he's respected by a leader, by his peers over time. And that has to be escalated in the film, unfortunately. Because what I really liked from the book that I wanted to see in the film is that once he starts to kind of gain that following, and you get these little references or things in the book where that kind of give you an idea, like, hey, wait, maybe they're actually following him now. They're trusting him. People aren't just hating him anymore. Because everybody resents him at the outset. But when he goes with his dragon army at one point down the hall, he, in the book, is like running and he jumps up and hits the spot on the ceiling.
Yes.
And
yes.
In the book, they explain how then everybody behind him, all his toons, all then follow suit. And when they reach that part, they all ran up and jumped and hit that.
Right.
And to me, I thought that was really, really cool. And having been in the Marine Corps, I found that was like a cool kind of like team building or rally cry kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then it was great because after the fact, I found out that the Marine Corps as an institution has put Ender's Game on one of its top 10 reads for Marines to read.
Really?
Yeah. So it has that military. It definitely spoke to me without even knowing that. I liked that I didn't know that first because it did appeal to me as a former Marine that I was like, wow, this, I can totally dig this because there's a lot of that legitimate training stuff going on in there that became very believable.
You heard it here first. Ender's Game, military approved.
Yeah, definitely. You know, and that's the other thing too, is you were talking about the character, and you know, I think the one reason the story is so unique and has such a pull on its audience, like you were saying about being like as an adult watching it going, oh, this is like kind of messed up.
Right.
Well, I think we're so used to seeing these adult characters that we're meant to connect with, but they still have a lifelong experience, regardless of who they are and whether they show us their past or not. We know we have, there's a general assumption that these adult characters or adult portrayals are people who have had like a lifetime of experience and morals and judgments and things. You're then now connecting with someone who has yet to have that life experience and maybe even has more, not a naive, but an untainted moral set.
Yeah.
And yet they're put in these situations. And so I feel like instead of connecting to the character in the normal sense, whether you're reading the book or watching the film, that you are now connecting to a character that, like, you can put yourself in their position because you too were a kid and when things were a lot more innocent. And so here this kid is doing that, and it really is just kind of black and white for him. You know, either he's going to do it or he's not. And that is a unique experience.
Right. I totally agree with that. Let's do a real quick just kind of overview of the movie, because I mean we're touching on a lot of different points, but the basic outline of the movie is you're in the future. We have at some point in the not too distant past been attacked by a race of bugs. They call them buggers, although I don't know if they ever called them buggers in the movie.
No, they stayed away from that for the derogatory connotation
of
that. They had to choose Formix.
Yeah, I thought that was a little weird, because bugger is such a big phrase in the book. But they had, so these bugs attacked us after a lot of you know, human sacrifice. We did defeat them. They ran away. And then now we're basically driving to strike back before they have a chance to come and get us. So the entire human civilization is basically pushing at a unified goal of getting after these bugs before they can come back and get us again. So they decide that the children are going to be the way to do it, because they can form them, they can bring them up, and they can look for very specific characteristics that are going to win the battle or get them in. And one of the things that they do bring up in the movie, although they don't talk about it quite as much, is that Ender is a third. There's population control in effect, where children or people are only allowed to have two children.
Right.
And because the children of these two particular parents have such promise, but the first two washed out, they were given the ability to have a third. Right. Now, I don't know.
It's almost like he was commissioned.
Right. Yeah. And I think in the book, they kind of explain that he almost feels like the government owns him.
Right.
Because he doesn't feel like he should have existed in the first place.
Right.
Which I think brings in a whole other element that they kind of glossed over in the movie. But yeah, so he's going through the training, and he's constantly just winning every battle and becoming the person that they want. And so they test him and they push him and they take him to basically the brink of what he can stand with his followers that he's brought up. And they take him out all under the guise of training.
Right.
And when they get to the end and he's beat the buggers in what he thinks is a simulation, you get the big reveal that it's actually all real. And ever since he came to his final training school, he's actually been commanding real people and leading real people, I mean, to their deaths without even knowing it, while ending this war. And so it kind of, you know, that moment of realization in the movie, when he understands what happened, I think they handled that so amazingly well.
Yeah. And that really is like the crux of this entire,
it is,
of this whole story. That's where the real meaning is. It's not that he, because like I too, in the book, you know, when I was listening to it, it's like I didn't necessarily see it coming, but I started thinking to myself, oh man, what if this was for real? That could be the thing of this, you know. I mean, you know, no, you can't surprise anybody anymore,
right?
But it's like, okay, yeah, fine. It was revealed that it was, and yeah, you still get that kind of cool reveal feeling. But being an adult, it's hard to be surprised. But then it becomes more about how that character responds to knowing, That and like you said, they handled that really well. Like that was the important part, was the remorse, the cerebral kind of acceptance of it all, and the fact that he was lied to, and that was where the real message is. And again, man, if you haven't read or listened or watched this movie now, you're screwed.
You know everything. It's too late. You've seen everything.
A little reference to extras there.
Yeah, little Patrick Stewart. Excellent. Yeah. If you haven't seen that, you need to go to YouTube, look in extras, Patrick Stewart.
Yeah, you're welcome, and Ricky Gervais.
Welcome. You're welcome, listeners and internet, because it's just, it's an amazing watch.
Oh,
it's 5 minutes of your life that you will definitely be happy.
Oh, it's worthwhile.
Spend.
Totally.
Yeah. Yeah.
While you're standing in line for popcorn to go see Ender's Game, just pull it up on your portable device.
That's right. Your smartphone, your iPad mini, whatever it is that you're carrying around with
you. Just make sure you silence it before you go into the theater.
That's right. You don't want them coming after you.
You don't want to get in the stink eye.
They'll yell at you, walk you out. Especially the hardcore fans that are in that theater, they're not playing.
They mess around.
So, what else about this movie, Jamie? What do you feel was done exceptionally well, other than what we've talked? I mean, the acting was just top-notch. One thing I really enjoyed was the whole interaction between Harrison Ford's character and the lady who played Anderson. I don't know what her name is.
Well, you know, I believe, I don't know if I know this for sure, we could check it out, but I want to say that at least I perceived, and this is, you know, not in any way a gender bias thing, but I believe that character was a male in the book.
Yeah, and I got that perception as well.
And I was totally okay with if they were doing some sort of typecasting and expanding that. It fit that character to be a female, if you wanted to imply some like kind of subliminal message that there's a nurturing aspect to her, to that character. Yes. It didn't matter in a way. It could have been more powerful if it was another male, but I liked that they had that female actor. And I can't remember her name, but
it's Viola Davis.
Yeah, she's great.
Spectacular.
Yeah, she nailed it. And nobody overplayed their part. And with someone like Harrison Ford, who, first of all, gives an honest performance when he's in, he's all in.
Yes.
Previews to this movie that I had seen, like the original trailers or teaser trailers, sounded kind of phoned in, man, to me, and I was worried, because just as many people were, because this movie just being made at all was a big concern of many fans of the book.
Right, yeah.
Because, like, how are they going to do this? And this guy, Gavin Hood, I can't remember what else I think he did the third X-Men movie, fourth X-Men movie, something, or am I completely wrong? Is it not an X-Men movie?
IMDb
off.
IMDb is my friend.
But anyway, it was the Wolverine movie.
Oh, so yeah, it was Wolverine.
The Wolverine.
It just came up. Origins.
So, yeah, Wolverine. It was the Wolverine X-Men film. And so, like, he wasn't, like, a blockbuster director. But in my opinion, this guy proved himself that he's competent. Because is something that not only had a great cast, but his directing had to have made a large impact on the way they interpreted it. Because I felt like, this is one thing I've been saying about this film, is that so many films based on a great book will simply stage a scene.
Yes.
And either to just go, hey, look, we really want to be faithful to the source material, or they're like, well, we need to pander to the fans of the book and do it. And it's either way, it comes off ingenuine somehow. Like, it comes off ingenuine if they're just pandering to the fans, because then they're not really putting a lot into it. They're just like, well, people aren't going to be happy unless we throw this in there. Or if they do it and they're like, oh, well, this is in the book, we definitely want to have this, it's almost like they don't quite get the emotional message that was why it was important in the book and how it fit in context. What they did was, and I hear that they had like a checklist of specific plot instances in the book that they wanted to string together, and that was definitely the right decision under this particular person's direction, because it played together well. While they had to oversimplify like the battle room, I saw more of it than I thought I would, because Orson Scott Card was making some comment about, like, oh, yeah, well, you know, we're not going to show too much of the battle room because we all know how boring Quidditch is to watch. whoa, wait a minute, Gavin. Scott Card. Those are the coolest parts, I think, of Harry Potter for me.
Right, yeah.
I loved watching Quidditch. Are you kidding me?
That was pretty much the highlight of the movie.
When they didn't have it in the last
spoilers, when they kill Voldemort.
Yes, but it didn't seem like they just did it just to do it.
Right, it didn't feel like a series of scenes. It felt like a very completely told story.
Yes.
And while I will bag on this movie for years to come for the things that were left out as a super fan of the book, as a movie, it was a spectacular movie.
Well, yeah. I mean, you even said, because you had seen it with your wife, that she had not, she was the one of the four of us that had not read or heard the
book. Correct, yeah.
And she was like, no, I totally got it. And I was watching it actively as someone who had not read the book to see if that would come across, because I think that's the most important thing, is that when you talk about making a film out of a popular book, there's simply just those people out there who are not going to read or listen to it. They're just never going to ingest that. Right. They're not going to, their savages are not going to, you know, enhance their lives by understanding the joy of reading or listening to an audiobook. This in a way is, it did what I hoped it would do, is like, cause the message is so important and so, unique and very genuine. Like the message he was getting across, this kind of like warning against the future kind of thing, which we have a lot, and a lot of science fiction does that, needed to come across. And I think they totally pulled it off.
Yeah. One of the things that I love about the story and in the book and in the movie is that it is science fiction in the truest sense of what science fiction was, mm-hmm. was meant to be.
Yep.
It's not just a bunch of stuff in space. It's not just this. It's a morality tale. It's a,
yep.
it's a
cautionary tale.
A tale for the ages that they happen to set in space to make it digestible for people.
Right.
You know, it's not just a flash, you know, oh, look at all this cool stuff. It,
right.
It really has a great story. That they tie through. And like you were saying, I was talking to Jenny about it after the movie, and I told her, I'm like, there's all this stuff they left out. And I was, you know, there was this and this, and almost every single point that I brought up, she's like, no, I got that. Like, yeah. She understood it.
Like,
not
it
having
communicated
read the
book. It through the film. Okay.
Right.
Obviously.
And so, you know, that put my mind at ease that they really did a nice job of selling the story and telling,
like, keeping it intact
all
despite
of the
all
parts
the,
and making
all the
it,
omissions,
right?
Somehow they still managed to do that. And the other thing I really wanted to see, and I think a lot of fans, from what I've seen online beforehand, wanted to see, and we don't get to see, is that Ender figures out, and they do this in the movie a bit, where like he figures out that you can intentionally freeze yourselves in
yes.
the battle room. But the one thing that I think the fans are all going to kind of be like, dang, because I was waiting for it too, and from what I've seen online, is that the whole idea of freezing your legs in the sitting position and then firing down between your legs,
right,
and so that you are not you have no target, that the opposing team, they didn't even approach that. And I understand why they didn't, because they couldn't get into all that. And then the other thing was the enemy's gate is down. That whole concept was just kind of like a throwaway, unfortunately, because that became, in the battle room, Ender's kind of trademark. And
right.
They kind of gave it over to Bean, you know, in a way. They, like, you know, he said they both kind of came up with it at the same time. Rather than in the book, it was a totally revolutionary idea, because everybody else was like going forward.
Yeah, they
looked at it as like a forward and backwards football
right.
thing.
They maintained their orientation from when they left the hallway. Not,
exactly.
Not understanding that once you are in zero gravity, directionality is moot, because
exactly.
up, down, left, right doesn't matter. So you just pick a direction and say, this is this. So in your mind, you can always orient yourself.
Right.
That was one thing in the book that they explained really well,
right.
Even in the first launch, like when they first
yes.
took off. That the people would get, the kids were getting sick,
right?
Because in their mind they were trying
to
force a specific orientation
exactly.
on themselves, and that was something that they really had to break down. And Ender was the first one to pick it up. Now they did give an homage to that in the
yes,
book
they did.
When Graf comes in floating sideways,
yeah.
and Ender's laughing at him, and he's laughing because, you know,
he realizes,
yeah.
like, oh well, it's silly because there is no up and down in space,
right?
And the fact that he's like, you know, is that funny? You know, and he's like, yeah, it is. So he tells the kids, no, it is. It is funny. And that's a really great scene. I want to take a real break moment from this. There was something that I don't think was at all in the book.
Okay.
And may have been, I don't know, but it totally killed me. And I haven't had a chance to say this, to, you know, share it with you. But when they were in the simulation classroom and talking about how they could do things and set up their defense or whatever.
Sure.
And Ender does it, or his, I can't remember if it was Ender or the other kid who does it. And, and Bernard says, hey, he cheated. And then
yeah.
and then Bean's like, your mom cheated,
oh.
and that's why you look like a plumber.
Yes.
That was like the best line. Right. Jenny and I could not stop laughing at that moment. It was so funny. Like, we laughed really hard at first, and then we wanted to keep laughing because it was just so great. It was something not necessarily from the book, but totally fit it. And then the other people, we were at a matinee, and there was people our age, you know, older, you know, 30-somethings and 40-somethings. So we didn't want to, like, keep going on, and we were, like, stifling our laughter. But, and, you know, in retrospect, it's like, had it just been us, we would not have stopped laughing. We would have had to pause it if it was our DVD, because it was just so freaking brilliant. It was so funny, man.
If it was Jenny and I, we probably would have rewound it a few times.
Yeah.
I had a similar, although somewhat opposite experience, only because we took Jacob with us, and Jacob is my son, who is 6. And as soon as he said it, I was just like, oh, let's skip past that. Don't ask me questions about what that means. Yeah. I don't want to answer that just yet.
Yeah, we arranged a babysitter, my Jenny and I. Oh, and just for you listeners, both of our wives are named Jenny. So
yes, and they actually have their own podcast, which is also starting this week. It's When We Rule the World.
Oh, yes.
Where they are going to be drunk, most likely, and just giving their unique spin.
Which we are
spin.
Not.
We are not, unfortunately. We were not well prepared this week. No. This almost didn't happen, but we pulled it together last second.
Yeah. But in the future, we promise you.
Yes, we will be at least tipsy.
You can hear our beer.
Yes, yes, there will be the beers will flow like wine.
And we enjoy good beer, so we're not like, we're not PBR men. We're not, you know,
no.
Schlitz or I don't know what, old style.
But now I will say I enjoy an old style from time to time.
This is a pretty crisp drink.
Mainly because that's what my dad, that's pretty much his go-to. So I developed a taste for it.
Fair enough.
It's a nostalgia thing more than anything. But I do enjoy it.
No other beer is made with croisening. Come on, man.
The croisening is really where it's at. Old style.
Sounds all nice.
Croisened.
Nice and German sounding.
You can sponsor us if you want.
In God's country.
Style. Yes. Yes, we'll croisen this podcast if you wish. my favorite right now is actually Blue Moon.
I haven't tried that yet.
I actually really enjoy it with an orange wedge. That's how they serve it in a restaurant, because it's got some orange undertone in it.
Mm-hmm.
It's good. I'm not going
to
lie.
Wow. Yeah, so hopefully in the future we'll be able to like have a beer of the week, and we'll be able to feature something and just shamelessly solicit or promote other things that people who don't even know that we're promoting them, who cares?
Right.
But
we'll
like it.
We'll just be like, give us money. We enjoy doing this, and give us money.
Yeah, I guess. So anyway, back to Ender's Game. There's something to note that we did talk about earlier, and that is that it became evident as you watch the film that you see that it didn't really kind of get too Hollywoodified, for lack of a better term, like the things of having a love interest or adding something that just wasn't in the book because some producer thought, well, we need to have this because it won't, you know, without it, audiences won't respond, blah, 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 you know, whatever. No, they really limited it to what the content in the book, and everything was based around that. And so I think that alone is good because as long as you're not taken somewhere else in the film, you can still always reflect on the book and know that that content is there. But if you're like, if you're told, like, for instance, in I Am Legend, while that was a good movie and I love Will Smith, the book, totally different. It's a totally different story. And why they can't just tell that story blows my mind. But that's another podcast.
That movie was a good 20 minutes. and then a whole big pile of poo-doo.
Well,
that's all I'm saying.
Just, you know, I really got off on Richard Matheson's.
I don't want to know about that.
I gotta say it quickly before it sounds bad. His
too late.
Crap.
So Richard Matheson got you off.
One foot over. No, Richard Matheson's like ultimate like sociological statement in that book is completely lost to so many people because you never get to see it?
No.
You don't get to see what his... Have you read it?
I have not, no.
Okay. I have the audiobook of that.
All right,
and you should definitely... You'd dig it.
I'll
maybe a preview of upcoming
things. We'll compare another movie to the book.
I'm telling you, that's a good read. Especially the audiobook. Again, a great audiobook for its interpretation and the acting in it. And it's chilling. It's also great because it's all about this guy's inside of his mind.
Okay.
And when you're listening to that, it's all you got is your own inside of your mind, and it's a cool experience.
All right.
So, again, possibly for another time. Ender's Game.
The Game of Ender's. I have to disagree with you, though, a little bit, just slightly, on your last point. I think you were talking about how they didn't bring in a love interest or anything. Okay. And I felt that they did not, but I felt like they teetered very close to it on the way they portrayed the relationship between Ender and Petra.
And Petra.
Because in the book... She was
pretty sweet to him.
In the book, she was older, and they were just friends.
Right.
Like, I never got even a hint of a vibe of anything in the book. And in the movie, I got the feeling that she was sweet on him, and he was just, you know, Ender, focused on his mission.
Right.
Which may or may not have been, what they intended. But I almost felt like they threw that, you know, they kind of pushed that. Although it could have just been, it could have just been that actress's, you know, just the way she portrayed it. Maybe she had a little thing for Hugo, I don't know.
Yeah, I can't wait to get my hands on that little Asa kid. And then I go, oh, now he's my height. Yeah, I think she shines. She totally shines. And I think I totally agree with you on that. Like, maybe that was something that wasn't there. I would more likely attribute it to being she used the one character in the film experience that you get that is unwaveringly in support of him. Yeah. And because of his lack of connection with his sister, who in the book, his connection with his sister is pretty strong. So when he's pulled away, that is some of the torment you do not ever even get close to understanding in the film. And again, it's not important to the overall story, but again,
I disagree that it's important to the overall story.
Oh, really?
Only because I read the rest of the books, and it's really a big deal in, I think, the third or fourth book.
Okay.
There's a lot, spoilers for book readers, sorry. They go into basically kind of like a trans-dimensional space. Have you read this?
Which one?
The one where they go into a trans-dimensional space.
I don't think there was a book entitled Ender in Trans-Dimensional Space.
Basically.
Oh, but look at me. I play the grand piano.
It basically, they played it out as it was this space where you could, it was where everything comes from.
Okay.
So you could make something from your mind if your mind was focused enough in this space. And he goes out there, and of course, who does Ender create?
Val.
And Peter.
Oh, both.
So he creates a Val and a Peter, which are actually basically parts of himself. But he creates Val not as she exists in the current world, but as we would have found her in Ender's Game.
Okay.
So basically it was when she met him on the island, that was the Val that he created. So it was like his idealized, because basically he loved her.
Right.
You know, she's his sister. There's nothing weird about it, but...
No.
You know, and...
I think there's some sort of like, there's some writers, you know, whatever they use, writers... I should know this. I'm an English major.
Yeah.
You know how they name things specifically.
Sure.
I mean, the name Valentine, like she's my Valentine.
Yeah.
There's a certain endearing quality to the name.
There is. Now let's say Abigail Breslin, which she played Valentine in the movie.
Yes.
I was a little surprised because she is a bigger actress than most of the other kids in the movie.
And yet she has such a small...
You know, aside. And yeah, I was surprised that she was playing such a small part in the movie. But I have to say that she nailed it.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, in the movie, she was spectacular.
Right. Now, I have to say, too, on this, I have to, you know, for me, it was a very personal assessment of all this. Because his relationship with his sister was very close to me. Because I too, have a sister. And she was older than I was, and she at times was the one who stuck up for me against my brother.
Nice.
And when I went away to the Marines, she was the one who wrote me.
Hua.
And so I was really connected to that part of the book where I felt like it was really such an atrocity that here he was writing and none of those letters had even gotten to her. And now he had changed, and you knew it. Like, you had traveled with him. You knew he was a different person, and you knew that if he was going to ever come and talk to her again, there was going to be a strained thing, and he was not the same person he was anymore. And my sister and I went through that exact same thing. Like, I'm not the same person I was, the same little brother she used to have, and I really connected with that. And the film has that really great scene where they're out on that on the lake.
Boat, yeah,
that's a key scene, and it's good that they put it in. But it's like I don't believe you get the full impact of the loss of opportunity and the irreplaceable interaction that is now, it's gone.
Right. And I mean, part of that is that in the book, there's 3 years, between when he leaves and when he gets to see her again.
Exactly.
In the movie, it feels like maybe it was a year, maybe 6 months. Right. It doesn't feel like it was a really long time. No,
and they couldn't do that, unfortunately. I wish they could have shown passing of time.
Yeah, but you know, and neither here nor there. I mean, I think, like you said, they did get the gist of it across, but it was much stronger in the book. But the other side that really makes that even more pronounced is because in the book, there's that whole relationship that builds between Valentine and Peter.
Exactly.
And we're not going to get into that because this podcast will be 4 hours long.
Yep.
But there's that whole relationship.
Just know
where
that there's a huge part of the book that is not in the movie at
right,
all.
Right. I mean, they get closer. Not in the way that that Ender and her were closer, but because he still has such an animosity against Peter and such like a dread of him, I feel that in the book it almost made that gap even bigger because mm-hmm. he feels like she has, you know, she was his most trusted ally.
Yes.
And she almost, in his mind, I think, betrayed him by going in and agreeing with Peter and you know, following through with his plans that he had.
Just to sum it up, all it is that they take part in a propaganda war against each other and become these really notable people in a thing that is worth noting, and that is that Orson Scott Card pretty much addicted to internet.
Okay, so basically in the late 70s, early 80s, Orson Scott Card predicted the internet, social networking, email, they even call it email.
They
call it the Nets. So, I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on here. I think that Orson Scott Card may have been traveling by Ansible.
He figured
out how to write it back. So, in conclusion, Ender's Game, fantastic film. I think that everybody should go see it. You should finish this podcast and leave immediately if you didn't go and watch it first, like we told you to. I would say what's our rating system going to be?
Ooh, that's a good
one. We need to come up with a rating system. You want to do beer bottles?
I think that sounds a little too.
I'm going to go stars.
A little too redneck.
You want to do stars? Thumbs up, thumbs
stars
down.
Stars are so typical and cliche.
Okay, we count toes maybe. Yeah. Like 4 toes up out of 5. I don't.
Oh man, it's hard not to like get myself pigeon-toed into something else or pigeon-holed, not pigeon-toed.
All right, how about we give it? I'm going to give it 4.5 dead buggers out of 5.
Okay, maybe we just cater it to whatever the film is.
Let's do that. So 4.5 buggers out of 5 is
four
what
and a half
I'm
giving. Oh wow, man. All right. So okay. That's a tough one. I give it a 5. I give it 5 buggers, man.
Right on. 5 buggers it is.
Yes.
So that's been our first podcast. We are super stoked if you downloaded and listened to it. Mm-hmm. Check back. We're going to be doing this weekly, and hopefully it'll smooth out a little bit. We'll probably always have children interrupting us only because we watch the children on Wednesdays while the girls have a girls' night. And that's when we're doing it. So this has been Fairly Critical, number 1, on the One Foot Over Network. I am Brian Watkins.
And I'm Jamie Lara.
Have a great week.